Please be seated.
We're ready to go back on the record. Dr. Deeth is still on the witness stand, and Mr. Mananoski, go ahead with your cross.
Thank you. Good morning. Welcome back, Doctor.
Thank you.
I first want to make sure I understand your hypothesis that you've come back now to talk about. And I want to put up your slide 7 that you provided in your direct testimony and make sure that I understand your hypothesis here. You have genetic risk factors, neuroinflammation, all impacting on redox capacity, is that right? They're contributing, along with the heavy metals, to create a situation of oxidative stress. Is that in a kind of a simplistic form?
I think you've captured that, yes.
Okay, and then the oxidative stress impacts methylation and neuronal synchronization on one hand.
That's right. I've chosen a couple of things to highlight here out of many, really probably too many to enumerate.
Okay, because it affects many things.
That's correct.
And then the other that's important for your hypothesis is that it also creates neuronal and glial degeneration. Is that right?
The neuronal degeneration, here I was referring to the relationship that has to diseases like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. The slide is not explicitly necessarily a autism slide, but otherwise in the neurodegenerative diseases such as Parkinson's and so forth, certainly the oxidative stress is an important contributor to that. Glial cells don't necessarily degenerate. You can have gliosis, for example, or in the case of activation of microglia, I suppose the term degeneration might not apply to those outcomes equal to neuronal degeneration. And it was the neurodegenerative diseases that I meant to include in that arm.
Okay, so then are you saying that the neurodegenerative diseases are caused by heavy metals, since that's part of this process, as you described?
They can be. I suppose the clearest examples would be even clearer for xenobiotics, but nonetheless, the idea that there's a contributing role, for example, for aluminum in Alzheimer's is certainly one of the theories, and heavy metals in Parkinson's as well, but exposure to paraquat in Parkinson's would fall in the xenobiotic category.
So is this presented as slide 7 to the court on an autism case? This is not specific. This mechanism then is not specific to autism. Is that what you're telling me?
No. It does accompany encompass other things other than autism.
So your process, as you've described it, is non-specific.
Excuse me.
It's not specific to the disease.
I think you made a jump somehow here between saying this slide is specific to my. If I could quote your question,
you presented this slide.
Yes.
In a case about autism.
Yes.
And it describes your process.
My process.
The mechanism how autism is caused by heavy metals.
Yes.
And you're telling me that this is not specific necessarily to autism.
I suppose I could counter by saying the brain is not specific to autism. So events that affect the brain but might not be occurring with the same temporal or developmental circumstances as autism that might occur late in life, for example, in the case of neurodegenerative diseases, might logically involve the same critical factors for brain metabolism. And so those factors are shared by different diseases, of which autism is one, but not the only one.
So this hypothetical process doesn't necessarily apply just to autism. It can apply to many different things.
I regret your choice of the term hypothetical process.
Right,
the metabolic features of the brain, which introduce vulnerability, apply to many diseases affecting the brain.
The process you've described is not specific to autism, then.
The process
laid out to the court is not specific to autism.
The elements, the things that I laid out had to do with thimerosal as a causative agent, and the time frame and the prevalence of its administration and its particular properties, that of inorganic mercury, and the developmental stage at which they exposed. Those things are specific to autism. And so, if
acting through the mechanism of oxidative stress under your hypothesis, correct?
That's correct.
And that mechanism is not specific to autism. Is that correct?
The mechanism can be important at other life stages in other diseases.
In fact, you yourself have attributed obesity to thimerosal, correct?
No, I believe, as we discussed in my my cross-examination, that I brought the to attention of people that I gave several lectures to the fact that the risk genes identified in autism have also been identified as risk genes for obesity. And to me, it raised the interesting possibility, and I did, and I still regard it as such, interesting possibility or hypothesis that individuals who are affected by oxidative stress but carry other genetic risk factors or experience other genetic risk factors, of which one could consider overeating, for example, a risk factor that by itself might not trigger obesity, but in the presence of oxidative stress might, I emphasize might lead to consequences. So this is a hypothesis that I've entertained.
Doctor, haven't you publicly stated
mm-hmm.
that you believe that it's at least possible that thimerosal in vaccines have led to an epidemic of obesity in children?
I object on the grounds that he's going off in other directions than we dealt with on the rebuttal. This cross... may have been appropriate 2 weeks ago, but it's not appropriate today.
I'm trying to understand Dr. D's theory.
Mm-hmm.
He's been talking about it this morning. I'm now hearing that it's not specific. I was trying to narrow it down to autism. I'm hearing that it could be Parkinson's, later diseases in life. I'm just making the point that he is not being, his theory as he's trying to defend it here in rebuttal, is not specific to the injury that you have before you.
Well, I understand your point, but you're not addressing Mr. Williams' observation just now that this doesn't seem to have anything to do with what he testified to this morning in rebuttal.
I would simply observe that to the extent he was trying to defend his mechanism, that it would. However, Your Honor, I will move on.
All right.
Dr. Deeth, glutathione, it's the primary intracellular antioxidant, isn't that correct?
That's correct.
So it's critical to, at least in your mechanism, to the role of oxidative stress. Its presence is critical to it, isn't it?
It's a major factor in determining the presence or absence of oxidative stress, that's correct.
And Dr. Jones testified that your body has abundant glutathione available, correct?
If that's correct.
You did listen to
his
testimony.
I'm sure he did. I'm just wondering about the fact that I don't have like verbatim knowledge of what he said, but I gather that's a general statement about what he said.
Well, you were responding to his criticisms of your work. You did listen to his testimony, did you not?
Yes, he indicated that there are... there is a lot of glutathione in the body. That's correct.
And you don't gainsay that, do you?
Gainsay meaning?
You don't contradict that scientific fact, do you?
No, I don't.
In fact, wasn't the thrust of his testimony to give context to this court about the amount of glutathione in your body versus the amount of glutathione that would be needed to metabolize the mercury that the body received? Isn't that correct?
Could you restate the beginning of your question? Because that was the intent. Is that what you
wasn't
said?
Wasn't the thrust of Dr. Jones's testimony that the amount of glutathione in the body can abundantly take care of. The amount to give context to the relative amount of glutathione versus the amount that would be needed to process the mercury that was received through vaccines. Isn't that right?
My understanding of his testimony, as I heard it and read it, was that that mercury would be overwhelmed by that large amount of glutathione and therefore should be, I suppose, innocuous or otherwise non-toxic.
Correct. That's what I understood.
Of course, this is in contradiction to our understanding of what mercury is, but nonetheless, that's the point that he made.
To your understanding of what mercury is.
I think mercury is generally regarded as both a toxin and a neurotoxin, despite the very high concentrations of glutathione that we have.
And the glutathione levels in the body are abundant, correct?
They are abundant.
Dr. G, how many articles have you published on glutathione?
Articles on glutathione, I guess one that's the review article. In fact, the Wally article that showed these effects in the first place, we weren't aware of the critical role of glutathione at that time.
So that didn't address it.
And so the other articles that are already out, I think there's only just the others that are in press, the two chapters.
So you have your one article that was a review article?
That's right.
And then the others are in press?
That's correct.
Do you know how many articles Dr. Jones has written on the topic?
Abundant, I suspect.
And oxidative stress is key to your mechanism, correct?
It is.
How many articles have you published on oxidative stress?
I suppose it's that same one, and this with regard to already
the review
released
article.
Articles. That's correct.
So it was looking at the work of other individuals, the review article.
I suppose we've done research that I've presented here that's direct participation in measurement of glutathione redox status.
This is the unpublished work that you presented.
The unpublished.
I asked you about
direct
articles.
Direct research that we've done. Did you ask me about what?
I asked you about articles that you've published.
That's right, and I said I've only published one.
The review paper.
That's correct.
That was 2008, correct?
Correct.
Do you know how many articles Dr. Roberts has published on oxidative stress?
Again, I assume it's a large number. I believe that's been the nature of his focus throughout his academic career. I don't know that number. Perhaps you can help me.
You mentioned the 2004 article by Wally, and I believe you're one of the co-authors on that study. Is that right?
Yes. I believe I'm senior author, but...
Okay, I'm sorry. The senior author on that study. Now, you didn't get that published at the first journal you went to, did you?
No, that was submitted first in Nature, then...
And they rejected it?
That's correct.
And then you didn't get it published at the second journal that you went to?
That's correct.
They rejected it. It was a third journal that you went to that...
Actually, I think this was the fourth. I think PNAS, I'm not sure whether I submitted it to PNAS.
I'm going to renew my objection. This has nothing to do with what we talked about this morning. This has to do with general topics.
I believe he was talking about his 2004 Wally article and trying to defend his previous opinion in this case.
Well, the article was discussed, but nothing about issues of how many publishers it went to, so maybe you should move on.
It does. I would submit, Your Honor, that it goes to what weight you should give the evidence that he's countering with now.
Well, of course, he discussed the Wally article at tremendous length in his initial testimony, and this is clearly the type of question that could have been asked on cross there.
Very well, Your Honor. Now, you, in your lab, an experiment, have found a dose response effect for thimerosal at the 0.1 nanomolar range. Is that right?
The way you stated that, sub-nanomolar concentrations cause significant effects.
0.1 nanomolar, right? Sub-nanomolar, then.
Correct.
And that was published in 2004. Is that right?
That's correct.
And since that time, that was tested. You were defending yourself this morning, saying that you were being criticized because you were the only one who had seen a 0.1 nanomolar effect. That was published in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
In 2005, Dr. James also tried to do a dose response effect, correct?
No, I don't believe that she...
PML-007?
Excuse me?
It was Petitioner's Master List 007.
She measured... Wasn't her effect? Did she measure? Did she measure the same thing that we measured?
Yeah. She was trying to get a dose response effect in thimerosal.
What was she measuring? I think I know the answer, and I'm just saying that you're not asking about whether did we measure the same things. I believe she measured toxic effects with a cell death endpoint. I don't believe she measured in SY5Y cells phospholipid methylation.
So she used different cells, and that's why.
No, she used the same cells. In some cases, she used, I believe, a glial cell line and a SY5Y cells, but was looking at the toxic effects for cell death.
When she reported it, it was at four orders of magnitude greater to get a dose response. Isn't that right?
In other words, the concentration needed to kill the cells was
to get
four
a dose
orders.
Response. Four orders of magnitude.
To get a dose response, killing the cells?
Yes.
I believe it was between 1 and 10 micromolar. So that would be, again, to kill the cells, you need perhaps at least 1,000, maybe 10,000 times higher. That's correct.
So 4 to 5 orders of magnitude.
Mm-hmm. She also had a 15% FBS concentration. These are details. There were some experimental details that were, I'll say, different between the two labs, but the end issue of the large difference between the amounts necessary to kill cells and to interrupt their function remains.
And the experimental details, that's what Dr. Jones was dealing with. That the experimental details can affect the results that one obtains on this dose-response relationship, correct?
The term details, I suppose, belies the importance of experimental conditions. We use 10% FBS. She used 15% FBS. The FBS is a source of growth factors that can stimulate the cysteine uptake through EA83. And as a result, can increase the cysteine uptake, making the vulnerability to heavy metal toxicity less. So at least part of that 10,000-fold difference could be explained on the basis of the fact that the availability of a cysteine resource was greater in her conditions. But the major reason is the fact that she's measuring the death of cells, whereas we were measuring, processes that were more functional and were certainly more, could say, subtle by comparison to cell death.
And you just said that the experimental conditions alter the amount necessary to create the dose response. Is that correct?
I noted these experimental differences. We haven't made a experiment out of testing those factors.
Humphrey in 2005, and this is Petitioner's Master List 008, the amount necessary to create the effect there in vitro was 2,500 to 5,000 nanomolar, correct? That is, again,
four orders. You'll have to refresh my memory, Humphrey.
Gentlemen, let's have mercy on the court reporter here. We're getting plots of times when both of you are talking at the same time.
I'm sorry.
And I can't imagine how I'll ever get a transcript of this, so... Please, let's try to go one at a time. Go ahead and ask your question again, Mr. Madmaster.
In the Humphrey article, this again was after your work in 2004, they required four orders of magnitude greater to get the effect.
I'm afraid the Humphrey article, you'll have to refresh me more than by the first name. I don't identify articles well enough by first name to know which one you're referring to?
Herdman, you familiar with that? Another article to test thimerosal, the effect of thimerosal in cell culture.
If I have the app,
PML024, you're not familiar with that?
PML024.
I'm sorry. Petitioner's master list 024. I was just doing that for the benefit of the record.
I would request that if we're going to ask the witness about an article, that you be provided a copy first.
These are articles.
It's reasonable. Why don't you ask your question, see what the question is, see if you need a copy.
I'll just sum up. Since your article was published in 2004, six additional researchers have come out and attempted to determine what amount of thimerosal is necessary to get a threshold effect, a dose response effect, and they were all four orders of magnitude greater than you. Isn't that correct? Greater than your 2004 article.
My understanding is that no one has measured what we measured. We haven't measured cell death. They have measured cell death and perhaps other endpoints of pre-apoptotic or other endpoints.
So,
but my understanding is no one has measured what we measured in the cells that we measured the way we measured.
So
there is no comparison. It's like apples and trucks.
So in the 4 years since you put that result out there about thimerosal, six researchers have gone around and your results have been out there addressing the question in the fashion that you did in terms of inhibition, and they used a different approach to measure the effects of thimerosal in cell culture. They did not adopt your approach to measuring the effect, correct?
At the risk of self-flattery, there's one or two or a few key things that cause and contribute to autism. If you're examining those things and measuring those things, you might find a differential sensitivity to the factors that contribute to autism. Death of cells is not a key feature of autism, and therefore the things that we measure have a unique likelihood of reflecting critical events, and they may therefore have a unique likelihood of being more potently affected by the same factors.
So you're the only one looking at this?
I'm the only one in...
Looking at this particular effect on cells.
In the system, in the human neuronal cells, I believe we are the only ones who have measured methylation status and redox status in human neuronal cells.
And when Dr. James, you've talked about Dr. James's work at length this morning, Dr. James, when she went to look at it after you'd done your work, she looked at it in a different fashion. She didn't even adopt your approach. Is that right?
And she measured the cell deaths, is that what you mean?
Believe so.
Then,
and she needed four orders of magnitude greater than what you had.
To kill cells. And I'm thrilled with that, and I'm sure every parent of an autistic child is thrilled that it takes four orders of magnitude more to kill the cells. However, I aver and otherwise base my testimony on the fact that loss of function in neurons in the human brain can occur with much more restricted levels of inorganic mercury.
And the other researchers have not taken up that challenge. They haven't seen to try to duplicate your line of research. Even though they're looking at thimerosal, they aren't looking at it to do the same effects that you are. Is that right?
Different people have different thrusts or research interests and or abilities and systems. Dr. James, for example, that you seem to be drawing attention to here, has drawn her attention, and admirably so, toward the clinical status of children with autism, measuring the very same thiol metabolites in ways that she's able to, and then moving on to look at the effect of therapeutic interventions. Thankfully, we're all not doing the same thing, but they're complementary to each other.
Now, you mentioned this morning when you were given an article by Arne Holmgren called Inhibition of the Human Thioredoxin System. You discussed this morning at some length. You mentioned, in fact, that you had a conversation with Dr. Holmgren 6 months before this article was published. Is that right?
I think I mentioned we had an email exchange.
An email exchange, very well. 6 months before this article came out?
That's my recollection, yes.
And you discussed your work with him?
I did.
Is that the first time he is aware of your work?
To my knowledge, it seemed to be.
And I was doing a quick look at his sources in terms of his references in this article, and I don't see your work referenced there.
Confirming our lack of mutual knowledge of each other's work, that's correct.
And so even though you had told him about it, he didn't see fit to really include it as important, at least in the experiment that he was doing.
Well, that's a very unflattering interpretation, but the fact is that when I talked with him, he indicated that he had an article that was already submitted, and I suppose in the absence of knowing me, but he's not going to necessarily, although he could quote our work, it's not, we don't study thioredoxin.
Yes, in fact, I don't remember you citing thioredoxins at all in your expert report.
Which is, I have to say, I'm thrilled to have this improved understanding of thioredoxin as a result of this proceeding, because from Dr. Jones and now Dr. Holmgren's and the occasion of this hearing, proceedings here, my attention on thioredoxin is now improved. Although I did, as you recall, suppose that thioredoxin or glutaredoxin were the likely intimate targets of inorganic mercury.
So your understanding of this topic is progressing as this litigation goes on?
Certainly, this paper has improved my understanding. That's correct.
And this paper came to your attention this past week?
That's correct.
When counsel gave it to you?
No. In fact, the sequence of events is I discovered it and gave it to counsel.
I see.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Jones, as was pointed out this morning, his work is mentioned several times in the thioredoxin article, correct?
Yes, it is.
And he, as you listened to his testimony, correct?
Correct.
And you heard him explain in response to counsel that this does not impact at all on the question before the court about thimerosal and its effect on oxidative stress or sulfur metabolism, correct?
I think he used words to that effect, although I believe that he used them incorrectly. I think he was somehow taken aback by the fact that his own work provided strong, relevant effects of evidence in favor of a likely target here as provided by this paper. And so my opinion from hearing him and the tone and I guess the nature of the exchange was that he was somewhat surprised by the fact that his own work seemed to support an important factor in the causation.
At least as far as counsel was postulating it, it was an important factor.
You asked me for what I thought
Dr.
his
James.
Remark was. His remark and his response to say that it didn't, in his opinion, have a bearing was, I believe, an attempt to isolate himself from the possibility that the thioredoxin would have, that because he would be in the awkward position of being a expert witness whose own research was had important positive relationship to the causation theory being evaluated here.
His conclusion under oath was that it did not have any effect on the issue before the court. It did not change it one whit. Isn't that correct?
I, That was the tone. That was the sense that I gathered from his comments. Whether you're asking me explicit about did he say those words, I don't recall whether he said those words.
And thioredoxin. How many articles have you published on thioredoxin?
I haven't published any articles on thioredoxin.
And in fact, you weren't even considering it in your calculations, at least as far as your written report or your testimony 2 weeks ago, as part of the equation in how thimerosal causes autism.
No.
Is that correct?
If I put my arms out like this and I sort of try to recreate my description of why inorganic mercury released inside the brain, preferentially from ethyl mercury compared to methyl, might have toxic effects on thiol metabolism, I indicated that its likely target was proteins in which cysteine residues like number 32 and 35 in the thioredoxin would, in fact, should be considered as the target, because I was trying to make it clear that glutathione interactions were not the point here, that interactions with proteins like thioredoxin was the point. So, I alluded to that.
You actually used the term thioredoxin.
I might have said glutathione, and I'd have to go back to see. But I think, as Dr. Holmgren's paper points out, these two proteins are, they share structural features in an intimate way.
And you acknowledge that Dr. Jones, in contrast to yourself, has published on thioredoxin.
Oh, I acknowledge that be happy to reiterate that.
Now, I asked you a question before, when you were first up here, about Jill James and the strength of her work, at least as far as supporting your hypothesis. And you indicated that her work was the strongest support for your hypothesis. Do you still hold to that?
In broad terms, yes.
You went through some slides this morning, and I just wanted to go through and verify. Slide 28 that you went through, that was never published. Is that right, the material on that?
That's correct.
And slide 34, the material on that was never published either.
Correct.
Now, you said that you really had not published this because you wanted this to be more complete with your understanding. Is that right?
In broad terms, yes. We wanted have an external reviewer or audience would be a more complete view of why the thimerosal, but it's not about thimerosal. As important as that is in this proceeding, it's really about understanding the role of methionine synthase in neuronal cells and neuronal tissues. And so we wanted to have a more, both satisfying to ourselves, but also to reviewers, more complete picture of these events.
So the picture is not complete at this point?
When we a picture of this nature is never complete.
And yet,
however, I do believe that with our recent recognition of the inhibition of the cysteine uptake, which accounts for the large decrease in the amount of glutathione, the decrease being 40%, we know that it's not just a shift in redox state, that, oh, that 40% just is now oxidized. That's not the case. We had to otherwise understand why the amount of glutathione would be quantitatively so much lower. And now we realize that it's because the uptake of cysteine is reduced proportionately. And so that is a major improvement in our understanding of the overall system. And to my mind, allows us now to go ahead and present a coherent description.
So at this, but just this morning, you were saying that the story, you're still waiting for the story to become complete. And that's why you haven't published it. You're going to get it ready for publication. A couple of months, maybe it'll be published. But at this point, the story is not complete.
Should be submitted for publication. I trust we're really talking about what are the factors that limit not only the choice to publish, but of course the time to do that with grant writing and teaching and other commitments and obligations. They play a role, so it's not exclusively a matter of completing the story, but that was the important thing, was to be able to have a adequately comprehensive body of data and knowledge about the system.
But you feel it's adequate enough, in your view, to present to the court?
That's right. Recognizing that in science in general is going someplace, and now we have made a significant advance, and enough coherence exists to update, if you will, our earlier paper, and convince other people as well as ourselves that that this explains the mechanism of the lower methionine synthase activity that we earlier published. Yes, I believe we're at that point.
You mentioned a moment ago 40% reduction in glutathione and its relative importance in this in the question before the court. And I believe you had referenced earlier the work of Jill James with respect to that finding in autistic individuals.
That's correct.
Did you hear the testimony of Dr. Aposhian when he was here? I believe you were in the courtroom on the first day of trial.
I was here for the second day of trial only.
Okay. You
and I have not seen, but you can perhaps...
Okay. You didn't hear his testimony then?
I didn't hear the first day of testimony.
Okay. Could we play Dr. Aposhian's testimony with respect to Dr. James' work with glutathione?
And mercury. Does glutathione only protect against mercury, or does it protect and aid in detoxifying other substances?
Glutathione is one of the concentration of glutathione in your liver cells is 10 millimolar. And that's a lot of glutathione, tremendous amount of glutathione. It is one of the major detoxifying agents in the body. All right? Does it detoxify other agents? Absolutely. There are not only metals, but many other agents. Glutathione is one of the major endogenous detoxifying agents that we have.
And there's
10 millimolar is no small amount.
It's a huge amount, is that correct?
It's huge.
So if the levels of glutathione are so low as to cause...
So low,
hypothetically. If your levels of glutathione are so low that you cannot detect, detoxify the amount of ethyl mercury in a mercury-containing vaccine, how could you detoxify any other substance in your body?
Who says the glutathione level is so low that it cannot detoxify things? I don't know. Now, what you must say is a glutathione level in the plasma is very low. You're quoting Jill James, or you're referring to Jill James' work. She did not do liver glutathiones. She did not do brain glutathiones. She did red cell. No, she didn't even do red cell glutathione. She studied plasma glutathione, and as I and everyone else have told her, plasma does not have a high level of glutathione. Most glutathione is an intracellular compound. Very little glutathione is found extracellularly. I don't know whether that helps you or not.
No, it helps me.
In fact, her work that shows the 40% reduction in autistic individuals, the toxicologist that appeared for the petitioner said that can be given very little value in determining what is going on with the amount of glutathione and what effect it has on the body. Isn't that right?
Dr. Jones, I think, said that. Is that what you said?
Dr. Aposhian. That was Dr. Aposhian's testimony you were hearing. He was discussing Dr. James's work with respect to glutathione.
Did he say that her work can be given little value?
He said she was measuring it in plasma, and that was not, as he said, he and everyone else, as he put it, told her that was not the proper way to measure for glutathione.
He didn't say it wasn't the proper way. Measuring in the plasma is measuring in the plasma. Measuring in cells is the measuring in cells. They're two different things. And certainly a diagnostic test of plasma levels is not an unusual thing to measure. And it's not wrong, and she measured it the right way. It tells us certain information. It tells us what the plasma level of glutathione is. Now, it doesn't tell us what the intracellular concentration is. It doesn't tell us what the brain concentration is, but it does tell us what the plasma level is, and a comparison among individuals that were fasted and otherwise drawn early in the morning and therefore have certain attempts to normalize any fluctuations in that has to be given the weight that that the data itself merits. In this case, the considerable differences, not only in glutathione, but in every save one analyte that was measured, shows a pervasive abnormalities between these two test groups, and in a subsequent study confirmed that autism is associated with a major difference in plasma levels. And again, you have to just understand that it's plasma levels. It's not wrong. It's plasma.
So you continue to maintain that Dr. James's work is the strongest evidence for your theory.
I certainly do, yes.
You discussed Maddie Hornig's paper this morning, and you mentioned the criticism from Dr. Berman, but I didn't hear you comment on that. What comments do you have on the criticism of Dr. Berman? Have you read it?
I have read Dr. Berman's paper, which did not confirm Maddie Hornig's paper. And they're both what they are, which is studies in mice measuring what they measured. They are important insofar as that represents a model system of thimerosal toxicity, especially on neural endpoints. As far as Berman's failure to replicate, I don't really have a cogent explanation for why it failed. There are noticeable differences in the way the animals were in the same litter, both treated and untreated. This may or may not have been a factor. There, I think, are issues to be sorted out between those two labs. And I suppose the paper in hamsters that we mentioned this morning adds an additional element, which on the face of it would strongly favor the Hornig's finding. But those people have to work out those differences. Science is such that as long as people aren't lying about what they did, as long as they measured things reasonably and in a common manner and by experimental methods that can be explained and replicated, that they should be able to figure out why a difference occurred. I trust that they will find
it. Dr. Berman used quite considerably higher dose of thimerosal in the animals
he treated. As part of his study, use an extraordinarily high dose.
And he did not get any effect. Is that correct?
That's my recollection as well.
And you said that this paper that you pulled out this morning, you believe contributes to the discussion as to which lab should be followed, whether it's Dr. Hornig's or Dr. Berman's?
You've added some specifics there, which one should be followed. I think it's a different species, so I found myself this morning wondering whether hamsters, because the extent of the damage and neuroanatomic effects that they observed in that hamster study, I said, gee, maybe the Syrian golden hamsters that they used are somehow more vulnerable, because, quite frankly, it goes beyond the Hornig findings in terms of the extent of the effect. And so I wondered whether or not their redox status as a species, being different than mice, might not make them more vulnerable. And that is just a thought on my part. And so my take of this other study is that it adds something, but it still needs to be understood itself, the same as the other mouse studies do.
And this came out in 2007, and really, I guess it was published in the Annals of the Faculty of Medicine of Lima. Are you familiar with that journal?
I'm not familiar with that journal.
Have you ever heard of it before?
No.
You presented a chart in your slides that gave you the whole hypothesis. In your slides, it was chart 41. That sort of sum up your hypothesis. And that was similar to the chart in the paper you referred to this morning, your review paper published in 2008. I think if we could put that up, show that the review paper you published, I think, was our... Let's see if I can figure that out. That was PML 563. This is on page 8 of that. And the other is your slide from your testimony is slide 41, the last slide. I think we've discussed that neuroinflammation was added to this, at least for the slide. But otherwise, it's the same. It's the same theory that you've published. Well,
it certainly is the same theory, yes.
And I believe you were saying that neuroinflammation has always been part of this theory.
The pathologic term of inflammation is not a biochemical term, whereas oxidative stress is not a pathologic term. It's more of a biochemical event. The two are closely related, and I wanted to make sure that that for the purposes of this court proceeding, that the terms relationship to each other was clear.
And as you were discussing this morning in your review paper, which laid out the hypothesis, you pointed out that you had discussed the Pardo paper in that and neuroinflammation. Is that right?
That's correct.
Now, in conclusion in that 2008 paper, you summed up, we'll pull that up again. This is PML 563. This is on page 9 of that. And if you can pull up the highlighted section. It's your description overall of what you observed in that paper. And you said specifically that the validity of any hypothesis requires that it accounts for relevant, previously disparate observations. You go on to say that you think that your theory accounts for most of those, but doesn't explicitly account for all of them. Now, what you say in sort of summing this up is, your theory, quote, may serve as a useful starting point that can be critically tested and accordingly revised and even discarded, end quote.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we stand today, correct? This came out in 2000.
And that it can be critically tested.
And accordingly,
well, first of all, it's a useful starting point. It can be critically tested and can be revised or discarded.
And that's where we stand today with your hypothesis, correct?
It's kind of a general statement about hypotheses in the flow of science.
Now, this is
they are not.
This is a statement about your hypothesis.
That's correct. Which is an example of a hypothesis in the flow of science, where things we don't know. There could be revelations that research will uncover next week, next month, and I would revise my understandings. I have to accordingly, but at this point in time, I've done my best to integrate and to describe the relevance of these events as they relate to autism.
And it awaits critical testing at this point.
Further critical testing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Williams, please go ahead.
Just a couple points. First, quickly on the hamster paper. Do you know whether that journal is listed in PubMed?
I assume it's not, but I haven't searched for it.
You haven't checked. And do you know that journal is actually a Spanish-only journal?
I would presume it is a Spanish-language journal.
And do you know when that the English translation became available?
I don't know that. This article just came to my attention. I don't know the origin or the history of that article, except I understand that the journal represents the medical organization in Peru and is considered, I guess, sort of what I might think of JAMA as being the Journal of the American Medical Association, that it somehow has a standing in Peru. But I'm not familiar with this article's lineage that much.
And then on your theory, that your hypothesis, as the DOJ calls it, do you believe that it is biologically plausible?
I have no doubts that it is biologically plausible.
And do you believe that it represents a logical sequence of cause and effect?
I do, and that belief is based upon a number of factors, not only relying on my own in vitro work or our own brain work, but on also the diagnostic testing and clinical testing and the therapeutic treatments that improve autism. All those things combined feed into my opinion.
And as far as you know, is it consistent with all published data so far?
All published data so far.
Is there any publication that would contradict part of this logical sequence that you've laid out?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay, thank you.
Anything further?
Yes, sir.
When you write for the medical community, again, 2008, you say that your theory can't account for everything. You said it can't account for autism observations, such as abnormalities in brain size, myelination patterns, or serotonin levels. Isn't that correct?
When I wrote that, I would be happy, since you bring it up, to indicate that there are connections with those things that I didn't think rose to the level of certainty that I could expand on them in that paper. For example, myelination. Myelination involves oligodendrocyte function, and the lineage of oligodendrocytes is regulated by redox status. I believe there was testimony to that effect by Dr. Nobles, for example. And moreover, myelination involves methylation of myelin basic protein. And so the methylation that represents could be subject to influences of redox. Moreover, brain size reflects the result of growth factors that signal through PI3 kinase, like insulin-like growth factor, that determines brain size. And we have shown that insulin-like growth factor through PI3 kinase regulates these pathways. So it's not like there aren't elements of this hypothesis or this area of science that couldn't relate to those things. The question is whether those areas are fully mature in terms of the studies that would allow a forthright and more definitive statements about that. But there are ways in which they easily could be related to this.
Right. And when you're writing about your hypothesis for the scientific community, you describe those as deficiencies in the hypothesis because you do not have enough information to account for it, at least as far as when you're discussing it with scientists, correct?
I put those forth as limitations that are not addressed by my hypothesis explicitly.
And when you discuss your hypothesis in the scientific community, you describe it as awaiting critical testing, correct?
I don't usually use those words.
A starting point that can be critically tested, doesn't that mean it's awaiting critical testing?
No, it's being critically tested in different ways. And in fact, it will await. The term await implies not yet happening. I mean, you're quibbling here, but if you want to quibble, we can parse this out and deal with it. But it's a hypothesis and remains a hypothesis. It will remain a hypothesis even after both medical, public, and legal opinion has probably weighed in on this or other hypotheses. I mean, they remain that. This is the nature of science, and you know what I mean by this, that, in fact, science doesn't stop. I mean, it pulls the plug, and a certain concept or a certain disease even is declared finished. And so there's more to learn, and I'm open to that learning. And I just put forth this as a hypothesis that is the best that can be summarized and formalized at this point in time.
And as you explained to the scientific community, one that when it is tested may be discarded, correct?
Every hypothesis has the potential for that, yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Williams, anything further?
Okay.
Is there anything additional that the petitioner's evidence want to put on today? I understand Dr. Deeth is your only witness for today. That hasn't changed.
Right. My understanding was we were going to devote the day to the Deeth topics.
Right.
And they were going to call somebody
right.
today to respond if they wanted to.
That was my understanding as well.
But we're finished with rebuttal with Dr. Deeth.
I just wanted to clarify that. Dr. Deeth, thank you very much for being with us again. We appreciate it. You're excused. What's the respondent's plan then?
We are not going to call anyone today to respond to Dr. Deeth, and we will not call anyone tomorrow to respond to Dr. Deeth, with the one exception of the new paper that was once the witnesses that we had in common. I would submit at that time that we had to testify about that, given that this is being to us today. Had we been going forward with what we knew of what Dr. Deeth was going to be like, I feel like we're probably going to get to the point after our witnesses come to the point of we bring that up tomorrow.
So that there's no, then, there's no more, if I'm understanding, I want to make sure, we've got no more witnesses for today, from either side. Tomorrow we have Dr. Kinsborn and Dr. Mumper for the petitioners.
That's correct.
All right, let's...
Just if I may, sir. So it's just Dr. Kinsborn and Dr. Mumper, not Dr.
That's correct. Dr. Greenland will not be called in rebuttal.
All right. Thank you. Maybe since we may have a longer day tomorrow, a couple brief housekeeping matters I wanted to raise with you. Just now, because we're getting down to the end of this three-week segment of the trial anyway, though we have some more ahead of us. But just I wanted to remind both sides that a number of trial exhibits have been submitted to us in paper form and discussed, numbered. Just a reminder that you'll need to file those formally in the King case, in the Meade case, and in the third case to be named later. And you know, both sides will need to have, right now I have 11 for the petitioner, 12 for the respondent. I've got a list here, and I think if there's any confusion when it comes to trying to file them about which is numbered, it's important that we get them filed with the same numbers that we use to identify them during the trial. Give Mr. Lowe a call if there's any question about that, but don't forget that we need to do that sometime in the next few days after this trial is over. The other issue I wanted to raise was the issue of the transcript correction process, and which I think was a very good thing that we did after the Theory 1 hearing in Cedillo last year and in the other two cases as well. The timing of that process proved to be not ideal. We, as you may know, we ended up with briefing. Much of the briefing process was done before we had the transcript corrected. So we have briefs that have pagination that's not necessarily exactly the same. So it's also, in terms of the getting the pagination, it's also important to the court reporting service that we get much easier to change the pagination if we have that. So anyway, our idea is that we want the transcript correction process to take place as quickly as possible here. Now, it's my understanding that nobody has ordered the transcript, specially ordered it on a short notice or something. That's my understanding. So I guess we'll get the transcript something like 30 days from the end of the trial, though I don't know if we're going to get individual day-by-day segments earlier than 30 days. But whenever we get them, what we did last time was the respondents had someone, I think, listen to the whole tape and make suggested corrections, and then we gave those to the petitioner's side. I hope we can do that process again, and that I know we've got additional autism things coming up, including the third case here. I hope that you be able to spare somebody to start on that fairly soon after we get the transcript.
I'll endeavor to do that, sir. I'm just a little reluctant to commit with my trial team behind me. They may start throwing things at me at this point. Maybe in Monday it'll be an easier pill to swallow.
That's just what we would, you know, the ideal we'd like. We'd like to do this so then when you both file your briefs, you just have to do it once with the proper page numbers, and it'll be easier for everyone.
And I know that we did actually turn it around fairly quickly.
Yes. I think you did. So I'm just hoping we can start
giving it to you first.
We can start that process promptly, as promptly as possible.
And I can say, certainly, as was the case with Snyder, to the extent that we could simply stipulate, we can move this process along more expeditiously. And I do agree it's in everybody's interest to have the common set of paginations and references to the transcript in both sets of briefs as that process goes forward. So we'll work to do that, too.
Filing the joint stipulation was the preferred way to go forward.
The other thing I wanted to raise today is just where you stand on the process of picking the third case.
I just told Respondents' Counsel this morning, Special Masters, that we have medical records for three additional potential test cases. Those are being delivered on compact disc to Respondent within the next hour or two, so they can do their limitations review and review it for any issues indicating a concession might be appropriate, either on causation or on aggravation. That'll be forthcoming. I spoke with Lynn over the break fence. And once those are exchanged and we get feedback from the respondent on those issues, I think very quickly, within days of hearing from them, we'll be able to specifically identify a case. I do want to raise one issue that has complicated things, is that the Asker case, which is still a viable potential test case, is one where there may be a conflict in that week of July, including other hearings in this proceeding, not in the omnibus, excuse me, but in the vaccine program. It's Kevin Conway and Sylvia Chin Kaplan and Ron Homer's firm's case, and trial counsel from that firm may have schedule conflicts with that week in July. So we obviously would endeavor to do everything that we could at our end, including working with the special masters and respondent, if that is the test case, to see if those can be resolved to have that case heard in that week of July. And I know the special masters have indicated all along, including the chief special master, of rescheduling other proceedings to accommodate test cases in the omnibus. And we're aware of that and are actively looking to see what we can do. But that's the status. The Asker case is still very much a viable case, and records are going to DOJ for review. As soon as that is done, we will very quickly have a test case identified as the third case.
What's the name again of the case where there's a possible conflict? Can you spell that for us?
I
You have it? You've got it? Okay. Anything else that we should talk about today before we break for the day? All right, then we are adjourned for the day, and we will commence for the last day of this three-week extravaganza tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Thank you all.
Thank you.